Welcome to our second to the last event of our Centennial Plus Five Celebration of Creative Writing at Cornell. We have one more event scheduled for November 12th featuring Kenneth MacLean and Bob Morgan, which will end our calendar year of celebrated alumni readings. So please mark your calendars. Today's reading, in addition to our year-long festival of alumni writers, has been made possible by the generosity of two anonymous donors who are Cornell alumni. Our well of gratitude is bottomless, and once again, we thank them for granting us this possibility. For me, it is a special, special event because both Sana and A are, even though Sana graduated in 2001 and A graduated in 2000, I feel as if they just left. You know, last year, they're just, it's remarkable to see them. Sana Krasnikov, who graduated with a BA in 2001, was born in the Ukraine and grew up in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia and the United States. A graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop, she is a recipient of an O. Henry Award and a Fulbright Scholarship. She is the author of One More Year, a collection of stories published by Random House, and it really is quite incredible. Her stories have appeared in the New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, the Virginia Quarterly, Epic, yes, Epic, Zero Throat, and Public Space. Earlier this year, Sana was awarded the Saimi Rowe Prize for Jewish Literature for One More Year. Given by the Jewish Book Council, the award is one of the largest literary prizes in the world. Congratulations. She has also been named an honoree of the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 and was a finalist for both the New York Public Library Young Lions and the Hemingway Foundation Pen Award for the Distinguished First Book of Fiction. Of her collection, Jonathan Rosen writes, quote, Sana Krasnikov is the real thing. Her stories take shape inside the specific world of emigres, wrestling with language and loss and the stubborn details of survival, but they open into the largest of worlds and speak a universal language of heartbreak and desire. It's my pleasure to bring you Sana Krasnikov.
Hi, thank you very much for having me here. I was walking around campus, today thinking about what to read, and I decided, oh, hey, Ezra, how are you? I decided to read something that I actually got the idea for when I was an undergraduate, and it took a while for my skills kind of to catch up with the vision of it, but I remember when I was at Cornell visiting going to my sister's medical school graduation, and I had a cousin there who'd lost her mother when she was two, and the people who put us up, this man had known her mother as a young woman, and she looked exactly like her, so he kept staring at her and staring at her and trying to engage her in conversation, and, she didn't remember her, so she just kind of blew him off, and it stuck with me, and I always, and it over the years, it kind of spun into something longer and into this character who, depending on what you think of him, he's either nostalgic or creepy. I don't really think it matters, but it's a story called The Alternate, so I'll read portions of it. Some of the wedding guests had started filtering out the doors. Victor looked around for Vera and saw her in the lobby, pointing to her watch. She didn't want to stay late, she told him. She needed to be fresh for her doctor's appointment in the morning. Can you hear me? Okay. I'll tell Alina your boy will call, Anna Davidovna said when she kissed Victor goodbye, and he patted his wallet to reassure her. Victor had asked for the girl's number on behalf of his older son, though he had no intention of passing it on to Stas. That would be wasteful, possibly even reckless. He'd written her number on the back of a dollar bill, having picked up the idea from a man at work. A young trader who liked to brag about keeping his girlfriend's telephone numbers recorded on pieces of cash in his wallet to avert the suspicions of his wife. Victor usually felt nauseated by such vain disclosures, but the idea had appealed to him. With a dollar bill, a man could easily feign ignorance. And when the affair was over, he could go and buy himself a cup of coffee. A small crowd had gathered around a montage of the bride and groom's childhood photos. Alec, the father of the bride, whom Victor had met 16 years earlier when their families had lived in the same hosting facility in Vienna, stood in the middle explaining to his friends that the wedding had been carried out in Orthodox tradition on account of the groom's family. The groom himself was only modern Orthodox, Alec explained. It was an important distinction. Modern, not modern, what's the difference? Asked a man wearing a shirling. If it's forbidden, but you really want to, it's okay, said Alec. Back when we lived in Queens, Vera interrupted, we knew one modern Orthodox couple. She glanced over at Victor, then carried on. They had a little girl and two boys. Sometimes the boys wore their kippahs, and sometimes they didn't. Maybe they thought God was performing spot inspections. All were silent for a moment. Then Alec and the man in the shirling broke out laughing. Spot inspections, that's good, Alec said, clapping Victor on the shoulder as if he'd made the jab. Except Victor didn't find it so funny. Wait until it's our turn for a spot inspection, he said morbidly. His wife stared at him in bewilderment, a small crease of spite forming between her thin brows. He knew what that look meant. When exactly had he become such a big Jew? And all he'd done was start reading those Tolushkin books before bed. If he wanted to find spirituality, she told him one night, why not spend an evening at the Metropolitan Opera? That was different, Victor had tried to explain to her. But Vera never really listened. She found all religion a little depressing and primitive. She walked ahead to the glass doors. Victor followed behind. She didn't want to talk about it until they were in the car. I'm tired of you embarrassing me in front of people, Vita, she said, slamming the door shut. They drove home in silence. Oh, she liked to say it was all religion she didn't care for. But of course she meant only his, he decided. All these years she'd kept her tiny silver cross, a gift from her beloved grandmother, in that little zip-up pocket in her handbag. And when he'd brought that fact to her attention, she'd howled that in 30 years of marriage, she'd worn it only once, after Dr. Nathan discovered a mysterious lump in her right breast. And when subsequent tests revealed only an innocuous cyst, the cross had gone quietly back into the purse. Because it wasn't like she'd been raised by a band of pagans either. But that was what you did for the person you loved. You became a practical secularist. You became a political centrist of the soul. I wrote them a check for $300, Vera said, turning down the volume of the music. I think that was enough. It was her policy never to write the amount until after she'd arrived at the celebration and taken a look around. You could have made it 400. The food alone was 200 a person. Who told you that, Alec? That's what he spent the evening doing, giving everyone the itemized breakdown just in case we were getting jealous by the wrong amount? It wasn't enough, Victor said. It was. Now let me sleep. Alec was dirty wealthy now. That was how Vera liked to say it, her special variation on filthy rich, an idiom that she'd originally aimed for and missed. At the beginning of the tech boom, he'd started a company that specialized in tax software, an idea that turned out to be miraculously recession-proof in the ever-changing weather patterns of the American economy. He, Victor, hadn't done badly for himself either, but the fact of it was, others had done better. Victor turned up the volume on the radio. It was Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto, a classic FM favorite. Long melodies and rhapsodic flights. That was why Mila had liked playing it so much. She tried to teach him to hear with her ear. It's sound, she'd said once. It's supposed to shift. It's supposed to slip away. Back in Zhytomyr, where they'd attended the same music school, Mila had become fanatical about Rachmaninoff and played him at every recital. Sitting through all those trilling harmonies had made Victor want to shoot himself. But the teachers loved it. He'd overheard one of them telling the school's director, "That girl knows what she's doing. The rest of them are still guessing." The rest of them, didn't that include him? Yet it was only after that comment that he'd started to notice the swan-like rise of Mila's shoulders, her foot's cautious tilt on the pedal, the way the piano used all the parts of her and required her like nothing else did. Loving Mila had been, at least at first, so much easier than hating her. Sometimes he still wondered if love could really start that way, as nothing more than temporary relief from envy. He felt around for his wallet, still in his pocket. He'd call the girl in the morning. That would be Martin Luther King Day. She'd probably have no classes. He would introduce himself as an old friend of her mother and ask her out to lunch. Simple as that. And if she didn't say yes right away, he could say he was calling to return some old photographs. Maybe he'd even bring them along. For years, the pictures of Mila had been wrapped in plastic baggies buried under the photo albums, excluded from the official parade of memories that gave every family its happy past. No reason not to trade them in for an hour with the living image. In the morning, breakfast was waiting on the counter. Garrick sat on a bar stool, lifting a spoon from his cottage cheese and watching the lumps dribble into the bowl. "It doesn't even have to be a big pool," he was telling Vera, who stood behind, bent over the dishwasher. She wore her narrow black pants and a cream blazer. Her hair was delicately combed back from her face. "Another party?" Victor said, sitting down. "I already told you I have my appointment today." Had she put on perfume? On his behalf, she wouldn't squeeze two hairs from her chin, but for her gynecologist, she became Gina Lola Brigida. She left her coffee cup in the sink and picked up her bag. Now that his mother was gone, Garrick turned to Victor. "It's not like the backyard is even real grass. You guys pretend it's grass. It's just dead moss." He pointed at the spotty row of trees marking their property. For 2 weeks, Garrick had been pleading for a pool. He'd become fanatical with the idea. A pool for the vital purpose of throwing pool parties. Nothing short could secure his son a place in the eighth grade caste system. And the older one wasn't much better. After Stas had boarded the bus back to Rutgers, Victor had opened his visa statement to discover a bill for $260 charged to a Westin uptown. It was dated January 1st.
$300 for a hotel room? You told me you were at a party in Queens. Who did you meet there, a duchess? I'll wire you the check tomorrow. I said I will. Stas had yelled into the phone from the safe distance of his dorm room. It's $260. You're acting like you're in chapter fucking 11. He could never win with his sons, especially when the shouting matches degenerated into English, as the boys always made sure they did.
Why don't we dig it ourselves? Garrick said. The shovel is in the garage, Victor answered. Be my guest. The clock on the stove read 11:30. He left Garrick in the kitchen, unfolded the dollar, and dialed from the family room. Three long drones, then a lifted receiver. There was no hello.
"This is Alina," Victor said cautiously. "Speaking." Someone was talking in the background.
My name is Victor. I was speaking with your grandmother yesterday.
The girl managed a pained laugh. She's resorted to handing out my phone number? Okay, gotta love that.
Yes. Well, I have two nice sons, he said with a laugh of his own, which she didn't return. But I am calling about something different. Your mother was a good friend of mine a long time ago. Now I have learned you and my grandmother are in New York. It would be a great shame if we did not meet. Might I have the pleasure to take you to dinner?
He thought about making his invitation more appealing by mentioning the photos, but decided not to overstrain.
It's nice of you, she said, but I really didn't know her.
I understand, you're busy.
No, I mean just that. She sighed, reluctant at being rude. People try to talk to me about her. I have nothing to say.
I'm making you uncomfortable?
Not at all. I'm not an unpleasant person, I promise, he said. For an hour, I can be very entertaining.
Right, it's just I have classes on Friday.
No, I guess not, she said, the resistance in her voice worn down.
He found a pen and wrote the address she gave him on 70th Street in the East Side, near where she lived. He repeated it to her twice.
That's right, fine, she said, terrific.
And then she hung up just as he was saying, terrific, back happily, though he wondered a moment later if he'd botched the word. In his mouth, it sounded like terrific, but it didn't matter now, fortunately. He'd done it. Everything he'd performed on instinct had been correct. It was the feeling he maintained until Friday, a mild euphoria suffusing him each time his fingers twisted the bill in his pocket. In the restaurant, Victor could see that Alina resembled her mother. She had the same tense pout, the big, myopic-looking eyes, a more Semitic variant of that actress, Rossellini. It seemed miraculous that she could be sitting across the table, lifting a fork to her lips, inhaling and exhaling.
I wanted to bring a few photographs of your mother, but I forgot. Maybe perhaps next time. He didn't know why he was saying this, except suddenly he'd felt the urge to suggest the next time before it was too late. You don't have to do that. We have photos hanging all over Babushka's apartment. My grandmother has turned them all into little shrines with candles and plastic flowers. You'd think we were Catholic. You live with her? No, I moved when I started medical school. It was too hard to keep commuting from Brooklyn. You know, for years I thought I had arthritis, she said, but it turned out I was just living around a lot of old people. But when you're a doctor, said Victor, you'll be with old sick people all day. I'll be an ophthalmologist. I'll work with the ailing healthy. She lifted her full wine glass, and Victor quickly lifted his in a mock toast. He could guess from just looking at her that a girl like Alina didn't phase out at the computer screen and bang her fist down on the keyboard like his son's until the shift key flew off and got lost behind the furniture. No, girls like Alina probably got up and poured themselves a glass of water. If things weren't going well, they went for a jog. They edited all the errors out of their resumes instead of staring stupidly at the skills paragraph after they'd already sent the thing in, wondering if they really had meant excellent, good oral and communication skills. The other students, they think as practically as you? I don't know how they think, she shrugged, but they're all amazing. One already had a degree from divinity school, she said, and was going to become a hospital chaplain. Another was publishing a paper in a public health journal on the role of lesbian caretakers in the AIDS crisis. They're very effective people. I'm ordinary in comparison. But you aren't ordinary at all, said Victor. She didn't interrupt him. You made it here all by yourself with no parents. I have a father, she said. He helps how he can. He had his own difficulties. My grandmother never thought much of him, she said. I guess she wanted to see my mother with you, right? She told you that, he said. In her way, she and her friends are obsessed with keeping a good man. That's how they all talk, like the Second World War just happened. Half the men are dead, and you'd better be grateful for the amputees. That's the kind of math they're used to. You are hard on them. I'm not. Have you ever listened to them? You'd think all of Minsk and Odessa were populated by professors. Every teacher was the director of a school, and all the nurses were doctors. Every morning, Alina went on, it was like I had to travel to America again on the subway. I'd be walking to the F train, and all the geriatrics would already be outside on the benches comparing their grandkids' starting salaries or whatever it is they did that early. She was trying to be funny, but her voice was too resolute. She had lost too much time living with these old farters. Victor leaned in toward her. You have to think of them like children. They're dreaming of what they'll be one day, except they dream it backwards instead of forwards. Like children, she repeated. And for the second time, he caught it, the lopsided smile of the original. How much had her grandmother told her? Certainly in all these years, Anna Davidovna might have mentioned something to her about his and Mila's once upon a time plan to marry. They talked about it his first summer home from college. He'd done poorly in his math classes and grown dispirited by St. Petersburg's wet hostility. But when he'd returned to school in September, his eyes had rapidly readjusted to the tranquil paleness, the endless array of canals and marble buildings. By the end of his second year, it seemed impossible he'd have to go back to Ukraine after graduation, get assigned an apartment with a low ceiling in a district thrown up from reinforced concrete. Everything was better in Peter, the streets, the jobs, the Gentiles. In October of his third year, he met his wife. They were married in March. Vera had grown up right on Vasilievsky Island. Marrying a native of the city was all it took to get the coveted propiska, a stamp in his passport that let him stay in St. Petersburg forever. That was what marrying up had meant in a classless society. And what would he have gotten if he'd stayed with Mila? At best, Vyborg for his first vocational posting, more likely some remote industrial hole, some rundown concrete suburb. He stopped going home after that. He couldn't risk seeing her. And running into her mother here at a wedding. But then so many of them ended up on the side of the Atlantic eventually, an entire world transposed like an inkblot on a folded map from one continent onto another. The old woman was so happy to see him. She squeezed his hand and kissed his face. Death, it seemed, was the great forgiver.
He'd been 28 when his mother had called from Zhytomyr to tell him that Mila had died in a car crash, returning from a concert. From his living room window, he'd looked across the water to the south bank of the Neva, where a line of stone palaces appeared to float. Then he'd gone into the bathroom, and with his knees pressed into his eyes, he'd wept. His tears seemed to last forever, an endless supply of salt and grief and water. But there was some other substance in that mixture, too, a lighter element that altered the pH of sorrow. And what could it be, if not, just possibly, relief? Thank you.
I've been practicing this all afternoon. How do you pronounce A's name? And let me try it. That Ratawo Lapshawo Ensap. Did I do that okay? Acceptable, right? Who we all know as our beloved A, and who graduated with a BA in 2000, is the author of Sightseeing, a collection of short stories. A was selected as an honoree for the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35. It's the same recognition that that Sana received and that Lydia Peel will be receiving this month. So Cornell has been pretty good about producing 5 Under 35 honorees. A won the Asian American Literary Award and was also shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award. 8 countries have bought the translation rights to the collection. His stories have appeared in Granta, Zoe Thorpe, All Story, Best New American Voices, and the Best American Non-Required Reading, among others. In 2007, Granta named him on its list of the best young American writers. Alan Grigrantis, in the judge's citation for the Hopwood Award, writes, quote, "Gifted with a colonial, global, Gallup subject matter, the writer does not rest there. He finds a deadpan, heartfelt voice, true comic scope, a whole new use for rage. There's a force and rich latent potential in all of his work." A, welcome.
Thank you, Elena. Can everybody hear me? Okay. Thank you, Elena. And I also want to thank Michael Cook and Stephanie Vaughn. They were my teachers here. This is really surreal for me to stand here. I have dreams about this. Usually halfway through the dream, I discover that I'm naked. But I also wanted to thank the Koshmans, who are also in the audience, for giving me a home here in Ithaca while I was here. I'm going to read a new short story, and the short story owes a great debt to a short story by Leonard Michaels called In the 50s, and my short story, my poor imitation, is called In the 90s. In the 90s. Everywhere you looked in the 90s, something was being torn down, something new being built in its place. Canals were filled in for city roads, slums were leveled, highways completed. Buildings inched higher and higher into the smog, offices, hotels, condominiums, banks. Foundations for the SkyTrain were laid, and ground had been broken for a subway system, a new international airport, a world-class convention center. Out of fields had emerged shopping malls, housing developments, sporting arenas, parking lots. Gargantuan overpasses rose to span the city's more congested intersections, Klong Tan and Si Lom, Sa Thon and Lam Sa Li. The future was everywhere in the 90s. We were always being reminded of it. It was being constructed all around us, above us, under us. You practically had to wear a hard hat to keep from being hit in the head. Some of our parents bought their first car in the 90s. Some finished paying their mortgages. Air conditioners were installed. Kitchen appliances were purchased. microwaves, water purifiers, food processors. We started shopping at supermarkets in the 90s, abandoned the morning markets. Bathrooms were modernized. No more squatting, no more buckets of water. In the 90s, we learned to shit sitting down, clean our anuses with toilet paper. The first time my mother used a new bathroom, my brother and I were summoned to watch her turds pirouette down the drain. "Isn't that wonderful?" she asked us in the 90s. And a nun and I murmured our agreement, dumbstruck, embarrassed, but also silently alarmed by the color and the consistency of her excrement. It didn't look normal. It looked like nothing we had ever seen. But it was the 90s. Nothing was going to get us down. We thought that the worst was behind us in the 90s. The military was out, democracy was in, there was peace in the streets. And the economy, oh, the economy in the 90s, it was booming, it was a tiger. We were going to be the new Japan. GNP, GDP, exports, median income, the stock exchange index, all seemed ascendant in the 90s. A middle class was also ascendant, and some of us were a part of it. Not rich, not poor, but somewhere comfortably in between, a new breed of people who no longer had to work with their hands. Some of us were not a part of this, of course. Some of us still worked with our hands. But in the 90s, more than any other time, there was optimism. Everybody knew somebody who had made a lot of money in the 90s, biographies of successful businessmen sold by the tens of thousands. Fanti Penjing, The Dream That Came True, was the most popular television show in the 90s. Every Sunday afternoon, somebody would tell their life story before a live audience for an hour, sordid, hardscrabble, pre-90s stories about poverty, abuse, neglect, disease, drug addiction, ungrateful children, etc. They always cried while telling their stories, and we always cried with them. It was always so moving to see this poor person weeping before a national audience. We were not yet suspicious of the things that we saw on television in the 90s. If you could have one thing in the world, the show's host would ask at the end of every episode, what would it be? And the person would say a little bit of money, or a train ticket back to their home province, or a prosthetic leg for their son, or to find their missing daughter, or dialysis. And invariably, the show's host would produce such things and such persons for them, and more tears were shed from the joy of it all, the joy of the 90s, when the lives of the downtrodden could be made a little better by going on television. I lost my virginity in the 90s on a marble floor in a rich girl's condominium while Fanti Penjing was playing in the room with the volume turned off. I was practically howling from the momentousness of the occasion, from the cold and horrible embarrassment, and from the bruising on my lower spine, when the girl looked up from her seat astride me, peered at the television, and said, "A noodle cart. You could have had anything you wanted, and you asked for a fucking noodle cart." She crawled toward the screen's blue light to turn on the volume. A woman with an ashen face was weeping over a set of aluminum tureens. I had just told the girl that I loved her. This was said in a moment of profound panic, the likes of which I haven't experienced since, and which I now belatedly associate with the 90s. But all she could do was recline her lithe, sweat-drenched body against the edge of her parents' leather couch and remonstrate against the limited ambitions of the poor. Few of us understood why we said what we said in the 90s. Some of us wish we hadn't said anything at all. We spent a lot of time in shopping malls in the 90s. A new one seemed to open every month. We didn't really go to buy things. We went for the free air conditioning, the food courts, the mad wonders inside. There was a zoo on top of one, an aquarium in the basement of another. Macaques screeched as they swung from post to post. Dugongs floated through the liquid ether like sedate albino spacemen. There was an Olympic-sized ice skating rink where I first held hands with the girl I would eventually lose my virginity to, the girl I would say that I loved, while we clumsily negotiated the ice together like fawns testing our new legs. There was a roller coaster that traversed the entire length of a mall, dipping and looping across the cavernous fluorescent expanse. Teenagers would smoke weed in the parking structure and go ride that coaster for hours. It was something else to hear their collective screams echoing around the Galleria, high above the subfrequent din of the mall's light jazz, the thousands milling below, the disembodied announcements for a lost child or an illegally parked car. That's the sound I hear now when I think of the 90s. A bunch of stone kids yelling their heads off while they rose and dropped and rose again to awesome, precipitous heights. Anand and I convinced our mother to ride that roller coaster with us once. She had seemed strangely silent all afternoon, none of the usual chatter or murmurs of delight as we strolled past the mall's gleaming shop fronts. We thought that the roller coaster might cheer her up. She took some convincing, of course, but eventually relented. As we strapped her into the seat between us, she said, "This is a machine for yahoos and kids. This is not a machine for an old woman like me." And when we made our initial ascent, she hooked her arm tight around each of ours and stared unblinkingly at her feet, her lips pressed together in a grimace. Amid the cacophony of the ensuing ride, while we hung upside down for a moment from the mall's glass and steel ceiling, I turned to glance at our mother. She was still staring at her feet. She had not made a sound. Her face had turned a pale, yellowish tinge. "Ma," I yelled at the mauve sky glowing below us, high above the beams. "This is supposed to be fun, Ma." And Anand in tone was something similar, but soon as the world corrected itself by a swift mechanical swoop, I heard our mother say in a strange banshee voice, "You shut your mouth. All of you just shut your goddamn mouths. I'm fucking dying over here." We laughed. We had never heard our mother swear before. We would never hear her swear again. And when she screamed that last little bit, the bit about dying, we thought that she had been speaking figuratively. Because in the 90s, we often took figuratively what we should have taken literally. Things were never the things themselves, but always something else. Buildings were never simply buildings, but signs of our collective prosperity. Industrial parks heralded our emergence onto the international economic stage. New highways were the roads we'd all take to a resplendent national future. And so we laughed at our mother as that roller coaster tossed us around the Klieg lights. Sorry. In the 90s, we learned to speak English. It was the world's lingua franca, we were told, the language of international business. You could practically hear the money ringing around in it. So we took lessons and dictations, we conjugated verbs, learned our tenses, practiced pronouncing our H's and our Z's. We bought shortwave radios and listened to the BBC. We tried to decipher British and American pop songs. On summer nights, we'd go to Khao San Road or Sai Khao Boy so we could get drunk and practice speaking English with Furangs. We needed to get drunk to talk to them. It was the only way to work up the courage. Before the 90s, most of us had never been closer to a Furang than the polite distance of a photograph. We'd wake up the next morning remembering little of what we'd learned, that we'd sometimes have pleasant, light-saturated memories of the language rolling off our liquor-loosened tongues like we'd been speaking it all our lives. Sorry. My best friend in the 90s was from a boy from Naratiwad near the Malaysian border named Gawin Panchangtong. Gawin was none too popular at school. He was shy and knock-kneed. He had blotchy, coal-black skin and a provincial accent that he was at pains to hide. And he spent too much time reading sports manga. But he thrived on summer nights in the 90s among the Furangs. He became a different person then. He'd wear one of his ironed NBA jerseys, waddle up to some white girls at a bar and say, "How do you do? My name is Kevin. I am not handsome, but you are beautiful." And more often than not, the girls would laugh and buy us all drinks. They thought he was so charming and funny. Thai girls would have told him to go back to the Malaysian border. In the 90s, late one night, he said, "I'm a poor Thai boy from countryside. I come from farmer land, so you buy me whiskey, yes?" And when the girls asked him what he'd do for them in return, he turned to me and said, "My friend and I dance secret Thai dance. We will do this for you. A secret Thai whiskey dance from water buffalo farmer land." "You're kidding," I said in Thai, smiling stupidly at the girls. "Tell them you're kidding, Gawin." The bar fell silent. All eyes suddenly seemed fixed upon us. "Okay," one of the girls finally said. She and her three friends turned to face us, resting their elbows on the bar. They were hippies, far as I could tell. Bandanas, beaded necklaces, fabrics with vaguely Asian prints. "What are you waiting for? It's a deal. You two do your dance, and we'll buy you a round of whiskey." "Here's the plan," Gawin muttered to me in Thai. "I'm the buffalo." I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. As far as I knew, There was no such thing as a Thai whiskey dance from Water Buffalo Farmerland. And I was pretty sure that the Furong girls knew this too. Just then, Pricky New broke out on the bar sound system, one of the most popular songs in the 90s, a synthesized dance number which compared the singer's love interest to an unbearably spicy chili pepper. In the 90s, there was a brief, inexplicable fad of pop songs that compared women to condiments. I am Buffalo, you see, I heard Gawain's voice declare in English above the music. And when I turned around, I saw my best friend hopping and galloping knock-kneed back and forth across the room, his fingers held up to his forehead for horns. He is my farmer, he said now, pointing at me, and I am his buffalo, and now we do our dance. I stood there before the Furong girls, not knowing what to do. I did a lot of that in the 90s, standing around not knowing what to do, overwhelmed, bewildered, astonished. I asked myself questions I often asked in the 90s, questions such as, why am I here, and what am I doing, and what do I want, and would my mother approve of this, and why am I best friends with a retarded black nerd from the Malaysian border? Many of these questions had seemed, in the 90s, very important and very profound. Gawain continued to prance around the bar. The Furong girls were practically convulsing with laughter before me. Somebody started to clap to the music. There was a swell of cheers, of hollering, a leavening of the atmosphere. Soon it seemed that the whole place had joined in. Some people got out of their seats and made their way to the dance floor, Thais and Furongs alike. Gawain wove between them all with his fingers still protruding from his forehead, his eyes bright with excitement, a grin smeared across his face, his voice singing along to the song, the refrain of which now seems inseparable from the 90s. Quote, a pepper that spicy, that delicious, should be eaten to the point of regret. What the hell did this mean? I wondered then, while the chaos mounted around me. Had the singer taken his metaphor too far? There was only one type of regret you could have over eating a chili pepper, in my experience, and that regret was always digestive. Relax, I heard somebody say, and when I turned around, I saw one of the Furong girls standing with a tumbler of whiskey extended toward me. Come on, she continued, taking my arm and leading me toward the dance floor. She was the first white person I'd ever touched in my life. Your friend over there has got the right idea. You Thai boys need to loosen up. This, she twirled her hands in the air and started swaying her hips to the music. This is the fucking 90s. In the 90s, it still meant something to get on an airplane. Tears were still shed at airports, handkerchiefs regularly used. Families huddled in small semicircles under Don Mueang International's floodlights, hugging one another, pressing each other's hands, taking photographs, as if they were sending their loved ones off to war. We weren't at war, of course. It was the 90s, remember. But when somebody disappeared through passport control, we often didn't know if we'd ever see them again. When our Uncle Jiachai went to work construction in Bahrain, our mother's entire extended family showed up at the airport, some from as far as Lopburi and Nakhonsawan. Even Gawain insisted on coming along. This is a big day for your family, he said. These kinds of things are just as important as weddings and funerals. My uncle hasn't died, I said. He's just going to Bahrain. At the airport, we met people that we didn't even know we were related to. And during the three interminable hours of waiting around, in the 90s, we often arrived at airports excessively early. While the adults milled about in a dense familial mass, trading news, cracking jokes about each other's complexion and weight, recounting old stories so outrageous that they seem, to our ears, invented and fantastical. And while some of our aunts wandered off to finger the duty-free, to rub lotions into hands and spray perfumes onto necks and sniff each other afterwards, and while our 80-odd-year-old grandparents sat sentinel by Uncle Jiachai like sunken, withered totems, refusing to let go of their eldest son's hand. While all of this went on all around us on that morning in the 90s, my brother Anand, Gawain, and I, in our boredom, slipped away to smoke hashish with the guy who claimed to be our second cousin. He had a horrible mustache. I hate to bring this up, Gawain said, when new cousin passed through the revolving glass doors ahead of us, but I don't think that guy's your cousin. I don't really see the family resemblance. Tell the nerd that he can stay if he wants, Anand hissed at me sharply. He doesn't have to come. That's not a problem. In the 90s, Anand did a lot of drugs. I only did enough for my brother not to hate me. By that point in the 90s, I worried a lot about my older brother. I worried about what our mother's illness was doing to him. I worried about the French philosophy he was reading at the university and how it had made him humorless. I worried about how he was gay and didn't seem to know it yet, even though everybody else did. But in the 90s, I didn't really know how to talk to my brother. New cousin passed us each a cigarette, which had been emptied of its tobacco and tightly repacked with hash. I thought we were doing drugs, Gawin said. A nun shot me a look. I wanted to dive headfirst over the edge of the parking ramp and take my stupid best friend with me. Who the fuck is this guy? New cousin asked. Are you even in the family? That's so funny, Gawin said, chuckling, putting his arm around my shoulder. I was just saying the same thing about you. By the way, Gawin added. He awkwardly stuck the hash-packed cigarette between his lips and smiled at new cousin. Just so you know, something's died on your upper lip. Anand laughed so loudly and heartily then, deep-chested, tremulous, that the luggage boys and traffic cops paused to look in our direction. I could have listened to my brother's laugh forever. It was an aria to me. The nerd's not so bad, Anand said finally, when he regained his breath, wiping at his eyes. And so, afterwards, back inside, as if through an underwater smear, the adults growing quiet as the time for Uncle Jirachai's departure drew near. Our grandmother's lips trembling as if they might unhinge themselves from her wrinkled face, flutter up to join the sparrows twittering beneath the terminal ceiling. My uncle, wearing the construction company windbreaker, the lycra, a green so bright it practically fluoresced, his weathered face a blank mask staring into the middle distance. The construction company representative checking his name against a clipboard. And now dozens and dozens of men like my uncle wearing that same construction company windbreaker, many of them beginning to line up for passport control, a mighty verdant army shimmering under the floodlights, some with their families huddled close around them, while those without had on their faces so much sadness and jealousy and fright and doubt and resignation that I wanted to cover my eyes. In the 90s, my uncle and those men and many more men like them would build some of the biggest hotels in the world. They would work on scaffolding so high, under a sun so blinding, that they had to bellow old tide folk songs into the hot desert air to try to temper the vertigo. And now our mother, who never cries, weeping into the hollow of her eldest brother's chest, without any inhibition, without any sound, her small back convulsing in his large, ropey arms, as if she was shivering and he was trying to keep her warm. And me only half comprehending then in the 90s that they are doing this because they both know that they will never see each other again, because our mother is sicker than anybody except a nun is willing to admit. And one by one, the siblings bidding goodbye to their brother, to Uncle Jirachai, whom I always admired and thought a cool guy, and who I suddenly remember had taught me in the 80s how to hold a hammer and drive a nail home. All of the siblings retreat in a semicircle, so that our grandparents can say goodbye. We turn away now. It is too much. The sounds in the terminal suddenly seem too loud, the lights too hot and bright. And so the four of us eye each other from our places in that family circle, Anand, Gawin, new cousin, and I, each of us tuned to our buzzing private frequency, sly grins and hooded eyes, and a small fist of laughter clenching and unclenching inside us like some riotous second heart. Just have a little more, sorry. We cremated her at the family temple in Sampeng, where our grandmother and grandfather had also been cremated just a few years before. By that point in the 90s, we had been waiting for it for so long that we thought we'd be prepared. We weren't. Nothing about the 90s could have prepared us for that kind of thing. It was hard, it is hard, to think of all that vitality and energy and love reduced to ashes in an urn. It was a small, quick ceremony. Everybody was there except for Uncle Jirachai, who sent us more money from Bahrain than we knew he could afford, and who called one night to say that there was work for me in the desert if I was interested. If I remember correctly, he said, you do know how to hammer a nail. But I told him that the economy was still a tiger in Bangkok and that I was actually no good with my hands. I also said my prospects were still bright for when I finished my university degree the following year. I told him I had big plans. This was a lie. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was still too full of grief and rage and confusion about losing our mother. And though I longed for a way out of the city, all I could think about when I talked to my uncle were those bright green windbreakers and the faces of those melancholy men. So I stayed in Bangkok in the 90s. Anand moved to the northeast to work for an NGO organizing the rural poor. At the newly renovated Hua Lumpong train station, my brother hugged me and told me he loved me. He said that he would never have survived the last 5 years without me. I told him the same. It suddenly seemed on that train platform like we knew how to talk to each other again. He also told me that he was gay. Congratulations, I said. I think that you're the last to know. Gawin moved into the house with me. At first, I said that I didn't need the pity or the charity, but he said, fuck you, I need the free rent. He was working as an entry-level clerk at the Thai Farmers Bank by that point, sending money home to his parents in Narathiwat and saving to get treatment for his knock knee. Before the 90s, when he was a child, his parents had tried everything, acupuncture, herbal supplements, massages, Buddhist chants, Hindu animal sacrifice. But it was only in the 90s that my best friend got the gait that he desired. The treatment took nearly a year, and on the day it was completed, Gawin and I got drunk and raced each other home, 6 long and dark kilometers across town, just to take his new legs for a spin. I let him win. In my own way, I also tried everything to get the gait I desperately desired: work, liquor, sex, exercise. I even spent 4 months at a temple cleaning toilets, sweeping the courtyard, feeding stray dogs, installing a new sound system for the monks. But for a long time during that part of the 90s, nothing seemed to work. It was still hard to go by that urn on the small wooden shrine above the kitchen doorway, a shrine that my brother and I had built with our own hands, and not feel like I was disappearing. My brother called me one day from the northeast and said that he was coming back. What about the rural poor? I asked. I was hoping that he'd be there doing that forever. It was something that had made him happy, and so often, during those darkened days, it was solely by the light of my brother's happiness that I could glimpse the possibility of mine. Oh, I haven't given up on them yet, he said, chuckling softly. They're actually coming with me. He said that they were going to walk the 700 kilometers in the northeast to the government district in Bangkok to call for land reforms, to protest corruption in agribusiness, and to ask for government aid. They would pick up more protesters along the way. The journey would take a month. I followed the marchers' every move in the papers, called my brother daily on his cell phone to see where they were. I pinned a map of the country to the dining room wall to track my brother's progress. I retrieved books from boxes that I had put away what seemed like a lifetime ago, economic histories and political theories and sociological studies that I was supposed to read while I was at university. I even read my brother's French philosophy books just so I could make fun of him over the phone. Day by day, they got closer. Day by day, the protests grew larger. One afternoon, my brother called and said, "You'll never guess who I just ran into. You'll never guess who just joined our protest. Mustache, except he doesn't have one now." They were 80,000 strong by the time they reached the outskirts of Bangkok. Gawin took off work so we could go meet them at the Democracy Monument and walked the last 2 kilometers with them to the government house. I took the urn down from the shrine and brought her along. We waited an hour in the rain with 1,000 others before we could hear the protesters chanting and singing, coming from afar, like some spectral choir vibrating in the upper air. And when at last they rounded the corner onto Ratchadamnern, we searched for my brother Anand in that mass of humanity. When we finally found him, we saw that he was with the cousin, who was now unrecognizable in every way. And we joined them both there, the 4 of us together again, our voices raised among the thousands while the banners billowed around us, marching through a valley of cops. That was how we ended the 90s. Thanks.